They are a key voting block in the Sunshine State heading into the November midterms just ahead. Could African-American voters in Florida be a deciding factor? Two analysts weigh in just a moment. Good Thursday morning. And live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. Hope you're staying warm out there. Keep it on 89.9 all through the day. For weather updates as we make our way through this deep freeze. Just ahead, analyzing Florida's African-American vote and the 2018 elections. You can get on the line now with your thoughts at 549-2937. Then later, we are kicking off a brand new segment here in the new year, looking at the arts community of this area. Don't miss the debut of The Art Attack with a panel of local arts and culture advocates. Plus, The Spectator will be along. She'll warm things up for us on this very cold morning with a look at January events all around the town. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, President Trump dominated the headlines Wednesday, along with his former advisor, Steve Bannon. That's due to the eyebrow-raising quotes attributed to Bannon in journalist Michael Wolff's new book, Fire and Fury, a shocking look inside the Trump White House. That got a lot of attention, but somewhat lost in all the hue and cry over that was another important headline. Yesterday, the president also disbanded his controversial and troubled voter fraud commission. Now, critics say the commission was founded to gin up concern about widely debunked claims of voter fraud. Opponents say it was likely a backdoor way to try to suppress the vote, particularly among communities of color. Back in June, the commission sent requests to states asking for all voters' names, party IDs, addresses, and even the last four digits of their Social Security numbers. The request was so sweeping that more than 40 states, led by both Democrats and Republicans, either partly or fully rejected the measure as federal overreach. Now, as that commission disbands, there's still a lot of discussion going on about the recent Senate race over in Alabama that saw Democrat Doug Jones upset Republican Roy Moore. Jones made it over the top in part due to extremely high turnout among the state's African-American voters, voters who told media outlets they were tired of being taken for granted at the polls. Here in Florida and in Duval County, black voters are also seen as a key factor going into this fall's midterm elections in a number of races. We're going to kick off the show this morning with a closer look as we welcome two local analysts. Our regular show contributor and WJCT board member, Charles Griggs, joins us. Good morning, Charles.
Good morning, Melissa.
And a new face here on the show, local attorney and political consultant, Obi Umuna. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. And full disclosure, you do consult for the Jax Chamber and a candidate for school board, Daryl Willey.
I do.
Just want to get that out of the way. And here's our question to callers. As we look ahead to the 2018 midterm elections, what are your thoughts on the disbanding of President Trump's voter fraud commission? And how do you see key voting blocks in the state shaking out, including the state's African-American voters? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect at wjct.org, tweets to at Melissa and Jax. And we also welcome your comments on our Facebook page. Obi Umuna, let's begin with you, a local political consultant. You were featured in the PBS documentary Post-Obama Drama, looking at whether black voters would turn out, whether or not President Obama was still on the ballot. And as we talk about this issue, let me begin by asking you first your thoughts on the president disbanding this voter fraud commission. We got that news yesterday.
Yeah, I think, you know, in typical Trump fashion, I think that was partly to kind of distract from some of what Bannon had said about him. But I do think that it was something that needed to be kind of disbanded. It wasn't effective. They weren't able to get a lot of the voter information that they really wanted. And so it really made no sense.
Charles Griggs, critics of the commission said it was a backdoor way to suppress particularly votes in black and brown communities. The president and the leader of that commission, Chris Kobach, disputed that. They said there was a specific need to clean up the voter rolls.
So voter rights policies are increasingly becoming an issue on both sides of the aisle. And because there was probably no there in terms of what the voter the commission was looking for, it may have been coming to a point where the strategy was going to backfire. But you can look at some of the strategies that have been going on to energize African-American voters, and voter right policies has been one of them. So if the commission was going to move forward and was not going to be able to prove anything that was seemed to be any fraud there, then you could sort of light a candle and motivate African-American voters more to address these issues of voter rights policies in states like Alabama.
It's 549-2937 to join us. Let's talk about the Alabama election. And also, by the way, at 6 o'clock this morning, President Trump tweeted this. He wrote, "As Americans, you need identification, sometimes in a very strong and accurate form, for almost everything you do, except when it comes to the most important thing, voting for the people that run your country. Push hard for voter identification." Okay.
I don't think anybody really... Nobody's going to argue that you need identification. It's the access to making sure that identification happens, that the follow-up to that. And with those laws that were being put on the books, there was also some pushback on and a lack of access being provided or reducing of access for identification for people to have the type of information they needed in order to present to get their to be able to vote.
Let's talk about those factors in the context, for example, of the recent Senate race in Alabama, OB, where particularly African-American women made the difference for the Democrat in that race, Doug Jones.
Definitely. I definitely wanted to speak on what Charles was saying, is that a lot of times with those voter laws, it's not about the law itself, it's where it's actually applied. I think you see that they're stricter in the black precincts, which prevent those people from voting. But in other precincts, they don't apply those laws. In Alabama, what you saw was this incredible turnout because there was an investment made into getting African-American people to vote in Alabama. And you really saw that.
There was
women.
A strong turnout operation. And so as we look ahead to 2018 in Florida, let's talk about some of the races that have caught both your eyes in this state and in this part of the state, and how you see this voting bloc weighing in as a factor, Charles.
Well, overall, the lessons that came out of Alabama is that for both parties, and the Democrats in particular, if they're not going to take African-American vote for granted, then they are going to have to invest heavily in not only a strategic ground game, but bringing in players, strategists, pollers, to be a part, an integral part of the planning and the strategics of putting together a campaign. That's what worked in Alabama. And so, the party and those people who the political action committees that are looking to get people elected across the state of Florida are going to have to adopt that same strategy as well. And the kicker is that they're not going to be able to wait until right before the election to do that. They need to start game planning now, bringing people on board now, and building a strategy and building their teams in order to take on some of these races.
Give us a call with your thoughts about the midterms in Florida and in Northeast Florida. It's not till November, but a lot is happening already. The number to join us, 549-2937. Obi Umuna, what type of gamesmanship is going on now in Florida on the ground in Duval, too?
Well, I think you're going to see one of the interesting things about Duval is it's going to be definitely a place of attack for statewide elections as far as local elections, because Duval is really an untapped resources of black voters. I don't think people really understand that Duval is probably the third highest location of black voters in the state.
After Miami-Dade and
Broward.
Miami-Dade and Broward mm-hmm. counties. Okay.
And so I think you're going to see a lot of outside groups kind of come in and start doing turnout work here in Duval. One of the things to go with what Charles said is, as along with black organizers, they need to actually really go in and help black media. Find black media outlets, put money in black media outlets, and really reach out to those people.
Okay. And here in this area, we're talking local newspapers,
yes,
like the Florida Star, mm-hmm. local radio stations.
Yes. Like the Free Press and also
the Free Press,
as well as mm-hmm. Social media outlets, people who are heavy in social media, who know how to get information out to all demographics. And another interesting part that that's going to play out here is voter registration. Here in Duval County, and we talked earlier about a little bit about African American women, but African American women, they outnumber registered African American men by 33%. So there's opportunity here to register more black male voters in Duval County. Not only would that bode well across the state, but it would also bode well for some of these downstream elections like councils and state house reps, house seats. So if you could get more African American men registered to vote, you would see some of these other seats to come in play that may not have been in play before.
Now, with the exception of Andrew Gillum, the former mayor of Tallahassee that's running for governor, there aren't a lot of top of the ballot African American candidates that are going to be up for consideration this fall. Here's a tweet from Brian. Why not get more African Americans running for office? Groups like Emily's List encourage underrepresented women to run. Is there a comparable drive to cultivate black and Latino candidates? There are a lot of local candidates running in Jacksonville, Obie.
Well, yeah, there definitely are, and I've worked with several of them. I think that's a great idea, and I think that's really one of the keys. If there's three keys, that's definitely one of the keys to getting more black voters is having more black leaders on the ballot. But also, being black isn't enough. It needs to be black people that are really speaking about black issues.
Well, not only black issues, but policy issues that resonate with the community. Because if you're going to be running and trying to be competitive in a district that has been typically, if you're a Democrat trying to be competitive in a district that's typically won over by a Republican, then you're going to have to work with issues that are going to resonate with that particular community or that district.
Such as?
We talk about criminal justice and crime prevention.
Well, that's a bipartisan issue.
It's a bipartisan issue, but the way it's framed from a Republican standpoint is, tough on crime. It's the way it's framed from a Democratic standpoint, it may be framed from we need to put in more prevention measures that are going to be more advantageous to the community as a whole versus just tough on crime. So that message has to resonate through the district, and the candidate just can't be black in order to do that. They have to have the right information, the right messaging to go along with that.
John tweets the show, why do we still lump people together based on ethnicity? Do all African Americans vote the same? Do all white, Asian, Latina people vote the same? I understand liberal, conservative, Christian, but not skin color.
And that's a great point. But at the same time, some of the social issues that resonate with African Americans aren't the same social issues that resonate with other areas of the community. And on top of that, and I think he makes an excellent point, there is a great opportunity. There's a great opportunity here to bring some of the non-party affiliated African Americans over to those are some of the, African Americans are very conservative at heart. If you go to a black church, it's very conservative. But when it comes to issues that work in the community, they become more liberal from a body of politic. But at the same time, so these some of those non-party affiliated people are the ones who would rather be conservative but don't want to identify as Democrat.
Yeah, and let's talk about those dynamics in terms of this dramatic outcome we saw in Alabama, Obie, where you had a Republican, Roy Moore, who under ordinary circumstances would have almost certainly won, but was beaten by the Democrat, Doug Jones, in perhaps the reddest state in America, in part because Moore was seen as allied with President Trump, mm-hmm. very unpopular mm-hmm. in the African-American community. And also, he had faced credible accusations of being a pedophile. So you saw this unbelievable turnout by, in particular, African-American women, who, by the way, after the election, were very vocal about saying, we are not going to support the Republican Party. At the same time, we are not at all happy with the Democratic Party that takes our vote for granted, doesn't run enough of our candidates, doesn't put us in leadership positions, et cetera.
Definitely. As a campaign strategist, I look at it and I see two things. I see a higher average of black people going out to the polls. But what I also see is that Doug Jones spoke on black issues locally here And when I say black issues, I mean issues that affect black people differently than other people. If you look locally, the Walking While Black issue is a huge issue here.
The Times Union investigation on pedestrian traffic tickets.
Which affects different races differently. And so when I see a candidate locally talking about that, they're really reaching out to a group of people that are saying, this is something that we've been saying for the longest time, but no one's listening. And so we need candidates, black or white, to speak on these issues. And that's where you'll start to see the turnout go up for black people.
One of the things that worked out in Doug Jones's favor was he had credibility from the 60s, from prosecuting.
He prosecuted the killers of the little girls that were killed in the church in Birmingham, Alabama during the civil rights movement.
That's right. So that gave him a little bit of something for them to root for and root behind. Then he came back and said, these are the policy issues that are important to me, health care, voter rights, so on. So it gave the people in the community on the ground something to work with, a message to work with in order to support him. And, of course, Roy Moore was helped by his baggage that he was carrying related to the sexual improprieties and so forth. While Doug Jones was working with his team and people in the community were working with him to support him, he was saying, I hear you and I identify with those issues. Mm-hmm. One of the problems with the Republican Party as it relates to bringing in African-American support is that because there's opportunity there as well, they have to begin to push back on some of the rhetoric that's coming out of their candidates and some of their elected officials.
As you pointed out, many African-American communities are socially conservative, yet but the Republican Party, which is the socially conservative party, has not been able to capitalize on that.
Yes, they haven't been because they allow a lot of the rhetoric that's very, very insensitive to the African-American community to go on.
So bringing that home to Florida, how do you see, let's begin with the governor's race. As I said, only one viable African-American candidate, Andrew Gillum, but he may or may not win the nomination. Gwen Graham, the former congresswoman, Bob Graham's daughter, could be the Democratic nominee, white woman. The latest polling on the Republican side shows Congressman Ron DeSantis down in Palm Coast ahead now in the polls for the Republican nomination for governor, ahead now of Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam, because President Trump the other day tweeted out, I like Ron DeSantis. Okay, so let's assume for the sake of argument we have a matchup between DeSantis and Gillum or DeSantis and Graham. How will consultants and operatives on the ground like you, OB, work in the African-American community depending on who the nominees
are? Well, DeSantis is the best thing for the Democrats because anything that Trump co-signs, African Americans are going to come out and vote against that. And so DeSantis is the best thing. Between Gilliam and Graham, what needs to happen, though, is they need to start now to build up their groundwork to get black turnout.
Yeah, and you know, I agree with Obi on that regarding DeSantis. The best thing for African-American motivation would be to have him on Republican ticket. However, when you get to the Democratic nominee, whoever that is, they're going to have to coalesce with each other. They're going to have to work together. You wouldn't want to see the same thing that happened between Clinton and
Obama.
And so the problem would be that whatever Gillum is proposing to be his platform should be in line with what Graham is proposing to be her platform and so on, and vice versa. So that's what you want. You want complete unity going into the election and in order to keep people energized.
And I think whoever wins needs to focus on Duvall.
Duvall doesn't get enough focus.
It doesn't. And looking at numbers and things like that, you know, if you can get presidential a type of turnout, you'll do really well in Duval. And actually, you don't even need to do that well. You need to do, I think, if you look at 2014 in Duval, there was 44% turnout, where if you could get it to 50 or even 48, you could really change how the whole state votes. There's just the amount of black votes that are in Duval and the fact that no one really focuses here is crazy to me, because you could really do a lot of damage in the state by getting turnout here in Jacksonville.
Yeah, I think the key number is going to be back to Alabama again. The key stat in that election was that Alabama African Americans make up 26% of the population, yet they were 28% of the turnout in the vote. That is phenomenal. Because when you overrepresent yourself in the turnout of an election, then you're giving yourself an opportunity to make things happen.
I'm getting DMs from people listening right now. For some reason, we're not getting any calls. It's 549-2937 to join us. Everybody's cold. I'm getting so much social media feedback, though. Here's one for you guys. Please note that Gwen Graham has key local endorsements from Warren Jones, Garrett Dennis, and Tracy Davis, three local African-American politicians.
Yeah. Endorsements don't vote.
Don't vote.
They have to go out and work. And so those people have to be active on the ground and making sure that their candidate is doing, is carrying the message.
And you tend to think of off year elections as favoring Republicans, older and primarily white Republicans are seen as much more likely to turn out and vote in an off year election than more Democratic leaning groups.
Yeah.
Do you foresee that to be the case this year?
No. I think there's always going to be a little bit of a less of a turnout with off years. But I think with the political climate that we have right now, and I think with the momentum that was built in Alabama, I think you're going to see African American turnout at a higher than normal level for an off year.
Yeah, and who would have thought that after President Obama was elected, that we would see the decline in African American voter participation in an election that was this highly charged with in 2016. It would have stood to reason that turnout would have been higher, even higher, or maintained its level that it did in 2012, but it did not. For me, elections are like Newton's third law. You know, for every action, there's an equal and positive negative reaction here. So what we've seen is pushback from 2016, what happened in Alabama. What we'll see from Alabama's election is pushback from that, what Republicans would counter. And it'll keep going back and forth as our politics work in order to keep us a balanced union here. So I anticipate that Republicans will have something to counter the turnout and the participation on the African-American level, especially the way African-American women came out.
Yeah, you're going to see strong efforts on both sides, of course.
Yes.
Susie tweets the show, there are grassroots efforts in Jacksonville to get all Democrats to the polls, not just African-Americans. I know of a group in Mandarin that's already working to do this in this predominantly white suburb. If we can improve turnout, we can win elections.
That's the key. I think turnout will always be the key. I think one of the things, though, is to get sustained turnout, right? And one of those things to do is to deliver on your promises. So whatever happens in 2018, if we predict what the turnout will be higher, that's going to be huge for what happens 2 years down the line if people can deliver on those promises. I think one of the things that Doug Jones did as a sign was he has the first black chief of staff in the Senate. And so that is a sign to
ever?
In this current Senate.
Okay.
And so
Democrat.
First Democrat.
Yeah.
And so that
is a Democratic black chief of staff.
Mm-hmm. And that's a sign.
So there are black Republican chiefs of staff.
I don't
Tim Scott.
Okay. Yeah.
Senator Scott. Okay.
His chief of staff is African American. And so I don't think that there's a better sign to African American that we're going to deliver on those promises by putting people in positions of power.
And that was a key piece of feedback that you heard from the voters in Alabama after that outcome. Voters in that state saying, yeah, we'll come out and vote, but you know what? Stop taking our vote for granted. Integrate us more fully into the party that we most commonly tend to support. Is that a fair criticism?
Now, and what that translates into, Melissa, is it's not just you want someone in there because they're black. What that translates into is that someone who's more sensitive to policy ideas and that are going to be pushed and motivated to be put forward by the senator. So if he'll have someone in place who can identify with those policies that are more sensitive to his constituents, especially those who help put him in office. And that'll be a constant reminder. So when you have people on
and he may not be in office long, by the way.
Yeah. So you have people around you who can help you craft your message and maintain what your constituents want, and what's going to be representative of what their community is, and then you're more able to react to those particular policies.
Yeah, I think black people are just tired of being a tool to get other people in office and not seeing anything from that. And so I think, you know, there is some fatigue and that it may have been part of why there was a little bit of a drop off in 2016 as far as turnout. I think I think they're just tired of being a tool.
Eric is in Atlantic Beach. Hey, Eric, thanks for calling. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. I'd like to speak to where I think the Democrats ceded the state of Florida to the Republican Party in the election of Marco Rubio when Kendrick Meek ran against Marco Rubio and Charlie Crist. In that election, the Clintons and Barack Obama came to Florida and campaigned not for the black Democrat, but for Charlie Crist. And I think that drove enough black Democrats away from the polls to allow the election of Rick Scott, who won by a paper-thin margin against Alex Sink.
Thanks for that, Eric.
Absolutely correct and fair assessment there. I recall that election very vividly. You know, for a long time here in Florida, people have not taken the candidacy of African-Americans in some of these top positions seriously. And I think that's what happened in Kendrick Meek's place, and as well as we had a previous African-American who ran for governor. And now with Andrew Gillum there, you see some evidence of people taking his candidacy more seriously than it has been in the past. Now, how that will turn out in the end, we don't know. But
He's had some issues in his campaign.
He's had some, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Mark in St. Augustine. Go ahead, Mark.
Hey, good morning. You know, just a minute ago, I believe it was Obie made a comment about, and forgive me if I'm a little off on this, but the comment had to do with when blacks are put into significant positions, chiefs of staff, things like that, but that carries a lot of weight maybe in the black community, and that's fine. But I guess my question is, it seems to me on the Republican side, on numerous times, blacks are elected or put into significant powers of position. For example, Clarence Thomas, Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, Mim Carson, Alan Keyes, Herman Cain, individuals who ran for president who had support of Republican individuals, but yet there always seems to be an asterisk next to their name whenever it's mentioned that, well, the Republican Party doesn't really care about the African-American community. I'm just kind of curious why those individuals, and I know there's more, aren't kind of given the credibility that Obie mentioned should be given to the, you know, people in significant positions of power.
Yeah, thank you for that question, Mark. That's a good question.
Well,
thank you. Obie.
Yeah, I think it's not, and I think we touched on this a little bit earlier, it's not just about skin color. It's about issues that resonate in the African-American community. And some of those people do not have the same viewpoints and really have the, basically looking at these African-American issues and really saying, hey, this I feel what you're saying. I'm with you. And I think that's the difference. It's not just about skin color. It's about issues.
Yeah, and I think...
If you're a black Republican, you're not reflecting the will of the majority of the community?
Well, I think in some cases, what you see is black Republicans being elected based upon their environment. You know, they are someone who's representing their constituency. So if they live and work in where these policies don't particularly resonate with people who they're working with, then they represent those. But I also would take issue with the fact that these African Americans are not respected within the community. They are. I mean, Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, even some of the people who will work downstream, chiefs of staff, they are very highly respected. They just have a difference of policy and a difference of opinion and ideology. And that, you know, just because they're black doesn't mean you can't debate that.
Good discussion, guys. And I hope you'll come back. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having me.
Charles Griggs and Obie Umuna joining us. And much more still ahead on the show later. The Spectator is going to warm us up on this very cold morning with some ideas for your weekend and the new year. But up next, don't miss the debut of a brand new segment on the show, The Art Attack. Back in a moment.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
For 60 years, WJCT has been connecting you to the best in arts and culture. On 89.9 WJCT, programs like Electro Lounge, After Hours, and WJCT Presents the Jacksonville Symphony highlight local and independent music. While on TV, you can enjoy the musical productions of great performances and hear the stories of legendary performers on American Masters. As we celebrate this milestone year, thank you for being a part of our rich history. WJCT is your community, your world, your arts and culture.
Join us Sunday nights for fresh programming beginning at 9 with On the Beam with me, David Luckin, as we spotlight music from the 30s and 40s.
I'm on the beam. Time's flying by.
Followed by Taste Test with host Damian Lamar presenting Urban Radio After Dark.
There is a place that I'm saving.
On the Beam and Taste Test, Sunday nights at 9, only on 89.9 FM. Your community, your world, your music.
For everyone discovering life after 50, WJCT proudly presents Next Avenue, a website where grown-ups keep growing. Visit us at wjct.org/nextavenue. It's today's modern guide for adulthood, part 2.
Hi, this is Keith Marks. Join me every Thursday evening at 11 p.m. for Avant Radio, a show of curious music for curious minds. Each show is themed, curated, and contextualized to explore new music. Come get curious on Thursdays at 11 on 89.9 FM.
Welcome back. Well, I'm reading the wrong intro. As the new year begins here on the show, we are thinking about new ways to cover this amazing community we all call home. And one area our listeners care a lot about is arts and culture. You might have noticed we regularly feature artists of all stripes on the show and talk a lot about the arts. Now, we've decided to do this in a more formal way, with a new roundtable on the arts, sort of like our Friday Media Roundtable. But we're calling this group the Art Attack. And we're excited to kick it off this morning with an amazing foursome as we welcome Lee Hamby of the Five and Dime Theater. Good morning.
Good morning.
Shawana Brooks is here, arts and culture developer at the Jacksonville Public Library.
Good morning, Melissa.
Diane Brunette Garcia, arts advocate and partner in the Brunette Garcia Agency. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Keith Marks of our own music show, Avant Radio.
Greetings.
Good morning, everybody. And as we talk about headlines in the art world, I'm going to begin by asking all of you about how the Me Too moment has come to the world of ballet. On Monday, Peter Martins, the head of the New York City Ballet, resigned, accused of sexual misconduct and verbal and physical abuse. Lee Hamby, even the art world is not immune to this.
No, not at all. It's been quite a topic of conversation, especially in the theater world when we're all so comfortable with each other and we see each other at the most vulnerable. And it's not just in the workplace, you know, the conventional workplace. So, yes, it has been quite a conversation to have.
Yeah. And Shawana Brooks, yeah, you think of the stage as sort of a place where artistic people have a haven from the cruel world, but not necessarily.
Yeah, you want to think that, like, a lot of times in these settings, with such creative people of all kind of forces and going around, that everybody's being respective and respectful to each other. So when you hear such hard allegations going forward, and especially from the top up from a company, it really makes you think, well, who was, what was happening maybe from the bottom down, that some of these things didn't get looked at beforehand.
Yeah. And here in this community, Diane and Keith, we have such a vibrant arts and culture group of artists and actors and musicians. This is something that I know people have been talking about. And another topic we wanted to bring up to all of you that I know you all have an opinion about is the FCC repeal of net neutrality and how that is affecting artists in this country. Diane Brunette Garcia, particularly for you as the head of an advertising agency, how is that playing with some of your more creative clients?
Obviously, we are concerned day in, day out with the freedom of expression. Content development is our game. That's what we do. When I started thinking about this, I thought, you know, I'm going to pitch this question to everybody in the agency because we have such a diverse group. And I thought I would get really diverse opinion. Universally, everybody is frightened to death about this development and what it means not only for society at large, but particularly for us as content creators.
And in particular, why?
When you look at the control of content, when you look at the access to information, we have to make sure that the level playing field stays, that it's always there. The internet's become almost like a public utility of sorts. Everybody needs to have access to methodologies and information that is available to everyone. And if when we start to shut that down, we're in terrible shape.
Keith Marks, if you're a small creator, content creator, or artist, this is not leveling the playing field, I guess, it's fair to say, for whatever you're trying to get out.
No, I would say it's going backwards in time. I mean, if you think back to the big newspaper days where, you know, publishers had political stakes and they had their papers feeding information to people, it was hard for anyone to get kind
to
of...
to break through.
Yeah, exactly. And so now... if we go, you know, if we take away net neutrality, it goes back to big players being able to funnel information down, whereas now it's a more open level playing field for anybody to be able to put content out and have it be seen.
One of the things that's really changed over the past couple of years is that carriers have amassed enormous content holdings. So when you look at what's happened with Verizon and Comcast and some of those acquisitions, it's a very powerful alliance, and it really will shut down content, even for some of the big people like Netflix and YouTube and some of those. I think they would be very frightened with this development.
Lee Hamby.
For us as a small organization, nonprofit, we don't have the budget to spend on advertising, much less pay to have space on the internet. So, you know, we really utilize social media only to advertise for what we do. And it's a huge resource for us to find new material and be inspired by other organizations. So if we don't have that capability, I don't see, you know, organizations like ours existing anymore.
Really?
Yeah.
So if you don't have that free channel, digital channel.
Yeah, there's no way for us to pay for that. There's absolutely no way for...
And what about public entities like the public library, Shawana Brooks? You're in charge of developing arts programs, arts and culture initiatives at the library.
Yeah, I mean, and so much of what you're able to get with that, what I think is helpful is that we have that, the free, you know, the public access of internet. So that's a lot of times why people even come in to the public library in order to get like those access to resources, which I'm sure might not change quite as much, but it certainly could. How much that would be as far as in cost, and how that would change with the municipalities and how they would offer free access to internet, you know, outside within Hemming Park and COJ Public. And those will be very interesting to see, like, how the content will be driven or maybe limited with so many things being free. I mean, we don't have any skin in the game when it comes to shareholders and providing for faster internet access. So even the traffic that could be going through our particular broadbands could be slowed down.
And
so
I think the whole concept of paid prioritization is a frightening concept.
Yeah.
Who determines, what content comes through and what doesn't, what becomes suppressed?
So I mean, if you look at like the politics of the day, I mean, it's whoever has the loudest stick, you know, kind of gets the attention. And
right.
So now we're going to design our information systems based on who has, you know, the more capital, more skin in the game. It's frightening.
And there's a bill in the Senate. Senator Markey has put forth a measure that would reverse the repeal of net neutrality rules. So how do you see... artist advocates, you know, who you don't tend to think of arts and culture advocates as necessarily political.
Oh, but
these issues are putting you into a political bucket now? Are you going to become activists on these issues?
I think if you look back to like things like the PMRC in the 1980s, you had people like Dee Snider and Frank Zappa. I mean, people who had careers on the line, and they put their name out there to be protectors of free speech.
Thank you for the Twisted Sister reference.
Yeah, anytime. But we're not going to take it.
I know, you're not going to take it. Exactly.
I think artists have a responsibility to become advocates and not just passively sit by and do this. There need to be more voices. And unfortunately, a lot of our pop stars are kind of manufactured and they're part of the system. And so those independent voices in arts and culture have been silenced by and large in terms of mainstream voices.
And how do you see the local community, if at all, organizing? Because what I see after hosting this show for 8 years is a very vibrant local arts and culture community. But I don't see it as a unified block. It's a lot of people in little pockets all over the city. Even though there have been efforts through the Cultural Council, Cultural Fusion, to kind of bring everybody together.
Well, this was the green room chatter before we came into this room. The fact that this unification of our segment and our sector has always been missing somewhat. And I think you could devote an entire show to just this topic, Melissa, and I think that it's going to take Cultural Fusion and the Cultural Council and individual working artists and arts organizations to demand that some of the organizations that represent us all get involved and become accountable.
Interesting, because as the Cultural Council has pointed out many times, this is a sector that generates a lot of revenue for this community.
Yes, most definitely. And that's exactly why I think that what we're doing right now is very important. And that's why I kind of brought this to you and the team here, is to get all of the arts disciplines in one room and be able to talk about this. We don't get to do that very often. We support each other and we go to people's shows and art exhibits and concerts. But being right here in this room together and having a diverse group of people to talk about things like this is so important. So thanks for having us on the show.
Sure.
And I would say their mediums are so powerful. Artists really do have such power and capability to be that force to galvanize those interests and to talk and to help to levelize that playing field so people can understand some of these political issues a little bit more better and not just look at the research that they would get from searching on the internet. Like, it really becomes like in your face and personal when you hear someone who you love and care about really taking on those issues.
I agree. I think artists are our most powerful advocates and activists. And I hope we can see more of that in our community.
Well, we'll continue doing this segment on the show. I think we're off to a roaring start so far.
Good.
Well, all right. What do you guys think?
I think so.
We're super excited to keep this going.
Yeah, it's nice to have this conversation with a bunch of artists.
Yeah. And so what else is on your radar in the minute or so we have left? What can we be thinking about for next month?
Holy. Ooh.
Well, I think, you know, to me, there's right now, like with the Me Too issue and even net neutrality, we're dealing with paradigm battles, right? An old way of thinking and a new way of thinking. And I think that for us not to be engaged at a micro level, we're going to miss an opportunity in the future. So I think you can pretty much open up the newspaper, look at the front page and pull issues out and say, how is this going to affect the arts?
And I'll say, when we're looking at paradigm shifts, for anybody who knows me, the biggest paradigm shift I want to see is that all artists are paid for their work, including actors.
Hear, hear, Diane, to that.
So. Yes. I don't think you'll get any disagreement from artists on that one. Diane Burnett-Garcia, Keith Marks, Lee Hamby, and Shawana Brooks, our debut panel on a new segment we're trying out on the show, The Art Attack. Email us with your ideas about this at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Thank you so much for being here today, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
We'll be back in a moment with The Spectator. Some ideas for a very cold January as we kick off the new year. That's
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
What should the nation do about DACA? President Trump says he is open to making a deal with Democrats to protect undocumented young people, but there could be political fallout. What would a deal on DACA look like, and what are the 800,000 people affected doing in the meantime? Next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
On the next Fresh Air, does President Trump have the power to fire Special Counsel Robert Mueller or stymie his investigation? We talk with Neil Katyal, former acting Solicitor General of the U.S., who wrote the 1999 Special Counsel regulations under which Mueller was appointed. Katyal says those regulations eerily anticipate the Russia investigation. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
It's usually a buyer's market when it comes to the labor force, but things might be changing.
We know that we need to come out of the gate with our very best offer because good candidates will leave, you know, before we even get them in the door.
I'm Lizzie O'Leary. How some workers have flipped the job market script. That's next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Follow what's happening at WJCT, even when you're away from your radio. Get the latest news, event updates, and see what happens behind the scenes. You can follow WJCT on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Wherever you are, WJCT is there.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, did you make it through the great freeze of 2018? Winter is here with a vengeance on the First Coast with that nasty cold snap, but we are going to heat things up for you right now with some ideas for your weekend and the first month of the new year. We had a hard freeze. There's even a thing out there called a bomb cyclone. But The Spectator is here to heat up a chilly Studio 5.
Aww.
Good morning.
Good morning. Happy 2018.
You are wearing a pink T-Mobile.
First of all, it's magenta.
Okay. You are wearing a magenta colored, it looks like a full body pajama outfit.
It's a onesie.
You're wearing a magenta T-Mobile onesie with a hoodie, pajama pants,
pockets, a zipper.
So you are bundled up for this bomb cyclone weather event.
Oh, this is the best.
You're enjoying this.
And before anybody asks, there is no trap door. People ask me that a lot.
What, in the onesie?
Yeah.
Yeah, how do you go to the bathroom in that thing?
You unzip it.
You got to take the whole thing off?
But you wear a shirt underneath. Come on, I'm a professional. I've been wearing onesies my whole life.
It's almost like a Snuggie. It looks so warm.
It is. It's lovely.
Now, as we all try to stay warm out there.
Yes.
January is off to a roaring start here in Jacksonville.
Yes.
Beginning with.
Speaking of the roar.
The roar.
Because tomorrow, Mayor Lenny Curry is hosting the mayor's Bills Bustin' Bash
at Everbank Field.
Yes, and of course the Jaguars are hosting too. But it is to celebrate the team's return to the playoffs. They will have live music, the roar, the D line, and some appearances by some Jags alumni. Of course, Mayor Curry and Shad Khan.
Shad Khan making an appearance. This is free. What time is this?
At the stadium. I think the gates open at 4. Gate 1. And I think it starts at 5, but they ask you to register.
Okay, now, speaking of the big playoff game, are you going to the game Sunday, the playoff match against Buffalo?
TBD.
TBD. You weren't able. That says to me that even you couldn't get a ticket.
Well, my birthday is the day before, so.
Really?
Really.
Well, happy birthday early.
Well, thank you. I'm finally going to be 30. Can you believe it?
I can. Susan Tedeschi is singing the national
That's
anthem.
That's a rumor.
A rumor.
A rumor.
At the
I
playoff
heard.
Game? That'd be great.
I heard that. It's a rumor.
Well, I hope that happens. Okay, also Sunday.
But you heard it here first if it's true.
Heard it here first. Also here in town Sunday, songwriter, singer, and rock and roll Hall of Famer Jackson Browne coming to the Florida Theater. That'll be a good show.
Yes, he will be here. And then, of course, Sunday, the big game.
Big game.
big game.
Nobody's getting tickets is what I've been
hearing.
No,
I heard they released, I think they're releasing some.
Are
I
they
say
adding
3
a few
PM.
More? Really?
I'm sure somebody will come in. But it was ones that weren't taken by the other team and other season ticket holder tickets that weren't. And I think standing room only also.
Wow. That's exciting.
Go to the website.
That's exciting. It's going to be a great game. Now, moving ahead into next week, do not miss Mama Blue at Crispy's Springfield Gallery and Pizza Place next Thursday night.
They won a local, there's an international blues challenge competition in Memphis, and they won the local, so they are going to compete internationally in Memphis.
Good luck
awesome?
To Mama Blue, a Jacksonville
God, love
treasure.
Me some Mama Blue. She yeah. really is.
Now, we're running short on time, but a few other news and notes. And by the way, this is all at Carrie's website at thespectator.com. Next Saturday, January 13th, is Hamilton Day at the Main Library.
Speaking of which, celebrating Shawana Brooks'
Alexander
idea,
Hamilton.
By the way,
that's
and
right.
I will be hosting trivia about Hamilton.
That's right. And not only that, you need to come out Thursday, January 25th, to Jacksonville Magazine's Best Restaurant Bash at the Jesse Ball DuPont Center. And last but not least, Disney's The Lion King kicks off at the end of January as part of the artist series. That will be
through
an amazing
February
show.
February 11th.
Come on out and see The Spectator tonight at Main and Six Brewing Company.
Yes, I'll be doing bingo.
I went to one of your bingo nights. Yeah,
was that you?
What a fun evening.
Was that you?
It was me.
It looked like you.
I was sitting next to you.
All I know. All I know is you kept saying, oh, I stink at this.
I stink. Every time I got close, the people at the next table over won. They won like every
There were two
round.
Tables that won everything.
I know you rigged it. The whole game was rigged. I know it.
Yeah.
Go to thespectator.com.
I'm not that smart.
For a look at events for your very cold January. And you might see her.
Wear this tonight.
You might be wearing this tonight.
I might just keep it on all day.
You look like Ralphie in A Christmas Story.
Thanks.
Except
I guess.
No bunny ears.
No bunny ears. No.
Always good to see you.
Always a pleasure.
And you're getting mail here now, so.
Yeah, I know.
I'm glad you have your mail for the month.
I know. I'm so excited.
All right. That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board during the hour. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chepchik. Never miss a show. Download our app. Listen anytime. Also at iTunes and Stitcher is the podcast. And our rebroadcast airs every night at 8 o'clock. 1A's up next with a look at what a deal on DACA might look like. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow for our Friday Media Roundtable. See you then.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.